Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today we're going to focus on the celebrity disease of the week. And this is truly a teachable moment. Tom Hanks, popular movie star, producer extraordinaire, a Hollywood celebrity, is announcing that he's suffering from type 2 diabetes. And you may have heard the story. It was revealed in an interview with David Letterman, and I watched the segment. What happened is Letterman actually complimented him on how good he looked, said he looks great, he looks thin, and Tom Hanks demurred and said, well, as a matter of fact, I went to the doctor the other day, and he said, congratulations, young man, you've graduated. You've graduated from pre-diabetes to full-blown diabetes. And Tom Hanks revealed that he'd been having abnormal blood sugars since the age of 36. He is now 57 years old. And the doctor said, all you need to do to avert this is get back down to your high school weight. And Tom Hanks paused for a moment, and then he quipped, so I guess that means I'll be suffering from type 2 diabetes, to laughter from the studio audience. And then David Letterman chimed in and said, well, I too have blood sugar problems. So this seems to be an epidemic in Hollywood. There's a lot of Hollywood celebrities suffering from diabetes. According to an article that I read, Halle Berry, Paula Deen. Halle Berry, it's hard to believe, but Halle Berry, who's slim and trim and attractive, suffers from type 1 diabetes. Paula Deen, that's not surprising with, you know, that kind of southern cuisine that she advocated. And Drew Carey suffer from diabetes. But have you seen Drew Carey lately? I think he's the host of The Price is Right. And he is virtually unrecognizable. He really got religion. And apparently he's on a very, I've read what he's doing. He's on a gluten-free, low-carbohydrate diet, and he looks great. So he's really addressing it. But there was a certain fatalism to what Tom Hanks shared with viewers and media followers in his interview with Letterman, like, hey, you know, what's the likelihood that I'm going to beat this naturally? I guess I have it. I'm just going to have to suck it up. I enjoy eating my food. I'm not likely to lose a lot more weight. And I was also listening to a radio broadcast on one of my favorite talk stations this morning, and the host and the co-hosts shared with a listening audience that they too suffer from type 2 diabetes, both of them, and that one of them said, well, you know, it'd be one thing if they didn't have very effective medications to control the diabetes, then you'd really be forced to follow a very rigorous diet and exercise program. But he says the medications are so good that it kind of takes away the incentive to follow a very rigorous diet and exercise program. And so we're going to take a look at some of the issues that are brought up by Tom Hanks' revelation that he has diabetes in this podcast. The statistics are, and by the way, we're going to come back to the assertion that the medications are so good that you don't need to follow diet anymore and exercise to address your diabetes. That's something that, that's an assertion that we're going to have to challenge. But what are the stats? Well, almost 26 million children and adults in the USA have diabetes. Most of them have type 2 diabetes. That represents 8.3% of the U.S. population. So this is a huge problem. But even worse, about 79 million Americans have pre-diabetes. And that's defined as intermediate blood sugars, probably metabolic syndrome with elevated triglycerides, higher risk for hypertension, cardiovascular disease, increased weight around the midsection, you know, the whole deal. One in three Americans may develop diabetes by 2050 if something isn't done to reverse the trend, according to government projections. So who's at risk? People who are obese, if you have a family history. African-Americans and Mexican-Americans and American Indians are particularly genetically predisposed to developing type 2 diabetes, maybe culturally predisposed too, because of certain lifestyle factors that may particularly afflict minority communities and impoverished communities. And, of course, the consequences of diabetes, mostly heart disease. Most patients with diabetes don't die of their diabetes. They die of heart disease. But also a high percentage of the people on dialysis in this country, which costs billions and billions of dollars, people who suffer from foot and leg amputations and blindness have diabetes, and stroke is also associated with diabetes. So they interview a guy here for a news story in a major paper. He's a government official. He says, the simple fact is that our healthcare system and our economy are being overwhelmed by diabetes. When we look at the number of individuals and the cost of their care, we see it's not sustainable. The cost of diabetes totaled $245 billion in the United States alone in 2007. Just 5 years ago, the cost was $174 billion. So it's diabetes is escalating kind of the way that the budget deficit is escalating, and diabetes is going to be a contributing factor because more and more the government is underwriting health care in America. In just 5 years, there's been a 43% increase in the cost of caring for diabetes. The number of people with prediabetes is overwhelming, and we haven't even identified the vast majority of these people. According to the National Diabetes Prevention Program, intensive lifestyle intervention with weight loss of just 5 to 7%, regular physical activity, and a healthier diet can reduce or reverse, can reduce the risk of or reverse diabetes. So so this is pretty amazing. Of the 8 million people who are diagnosed, an additional 7 million are undiagnosed. And that may be just even a optimistic estimate, because I see numerous individuals. They come to my office and they have diabetes. It just hasn't been picked up. And it's not because they're not seeing doctors. It's just that their doctors are sometimes not focusing on this, or they're very lenient in their criteria for diagnosing diabetes. We could pick up prediabetes with a test called a hemoglobin A1C, which is usually the criterion for that for diabetes, is it's got to be less than 6. But even in some patients who were hemoglobin A1C is 5.7 or 5.8, which is considered in the normal range, on a glucose tolerance test, we might see very, very dramatic increases in insulin response to glucose. Very high levels of insulin suggest insulin resistance. And insulin resistance is a hallmark of metabolic syndrome, which is prediabetes, often leading to full-blown type 2 diabetes. So let's look briefly at this assertion, because rather blithely, Tom Hanks and a couple of radio hosts that anchor the morning show said, you know, the medications are pretty good, and our diabetes is now medically managed and is well under control. Well, that is a controversial assertion, because only one diabetes medication, the oldest and possibly one of the cheapest, seems to be successful at somewhat reducing the ultimate risk of death due to type 2 diabetes. And that's an old-fashioned medication called metformin, sometimes brand name referred to as Glucophage. And that is a medication that actually, among the medications, that's the one I'm most likely to use if we really need to use medication for diabetics. But there's been some problems with all the major diabetes medications, in particular the sulfonylurea medications. They lower blood sugar, but they somewhat increase cardiovascular death risk. And that came out way back when, in the 1990s. and before. So they went on to develop newer medications. And part of the problem is that many of these medications are very effective at lowering blood sugar. Some of them make you gain weight, which isn't good. And many of them have not been shown to ultimately reduce the risk of death, which is, after all, the point of diabetes, of any kind of medication. It's not just to treat a number, you know, like cholesterol medication that lowers cholesterol, but if it doesn't reduce the risk of death, what's the point? Or heart attack or stroke, what's the point of these medications? And so it is with many of these medications, and some of them have actually come in the crosshairs because they appear to not just not reduce the risk of death, but increase the risk of death. So this is not good. This is not good, the situation. We got more and more people developing diabetes. Many people believe that medicine is modern medicine will arrive with a fix, and that they can rely on medical advances to take care of their problems. And you know, even if you can forestall some of the complications of diabetes, there's still problems that are hard to prevent, blindness, kidney problems, and so on. So, you know, let's take a look at some of the natural interventions for dealing with type 2 diabetes. And I guess it's a good point to focus in again on Tom Hanks' particular predicament, because if you follow Tom Hanks' career, he's been up and down in weight. I mean, you see this in some of the roles that he's done. He's fattened up for some of the roles. And in one very memorable role, he portrayed a castaway in the movie Castaway. He got stuck on an uninhabited island, and he subsisted on fish that he could catch and coconuts, and he lost scads and scads of weight. And in fact, for that movie role, he got back down to 170 pounds, which is maybe not quite his high school weight, but pretty darn near and pretty close to optimal weight for a guy of his size. However, he's been as high as over 230 pounds. So, you know, this is actually a source of speculation in the news. I looked at some of the news stories about this. Is there evidence that yo-yo dieting or weight fluctuation can increase the risk of developing type 2 diabetes? And in fact, there is such a study. It goes back to 1992. And doctors have observed this, but, you know, has there been a study to prove this? Well, yeah, there is a study. It says, I have the summary here. The association of long-term weight fluctuation with non-insulin-dependent diabetes was investigated for 8,232 white female members of a program called TOPS, which is Taking Off Pounds Sensibly. They're between the ages of 40 and 50. And so they looked at just ups and downs in weight, because clearly they were trying to take off pounds, some of them more successfully than others. Some of them may have yo-yo dieted, gaining and losing lots of pounds. And what they found was that weight fluctuation, it wasn't, and they actually corrected for weight. You might say, well, okay, you know, if they gained back the weight, then they were fat, then they got diabetes. But no, they compared them to people of comparable weight, but they just looked at fluctuation, ups and downs of weight. And what they found was that the magnitude of long-term weight fluctuation is associated with the development of non-insulin-dependent diabetes. So Tom Hanks is an artiste, and what will he not do for the sake of art and the marvelous tradition of acting and film? He's undertaken amazing feats of weight gain and weight loss to more authentically portray characters. But he says, you know, I'm not going to bother to lose a lot of weight to make dramatic inroads against my weight gain when I'm faced with a critical life-threatening health problem. That's kind of a paradoxical attitude. But most of us, I think, probably would fall into that category. We'd say, well, you know, You know, what are the chances that I'm going to drastically alter my lifestyle even when faced with a medical problem? Patients who come to see me at the Hoffman Center, many of them are very, very motivated and they're willing to do that. But that's a very small fraction of the overall populace of the United States. So, so let's take a look at, the evidence for, let's call it the Castaway program, for alleviating diabetes. Remember that program consisted of, intense exercise and severe caloric restriction. And in fact, intermittent fasting, because, when you remember all the trouble that he had trying to catch a fish and all that, work that he had to do to find stuff to eat on that, desolate island. Well, there's actually research that looks at the effects of what's called intermittent fasting. There's a review in the British Journal of Diabetes and Vascular Disease. It suggests that fasting diets may help those with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. So it's not just about lowering weight. There's actually a popular diet approach, particularly it seems to really caught on in the UK and in Europe. There's a popular diet book over there, apparently a bestseller, about intermittent fasting. So they investigated it. The basic format of intermittent fasting is to alternate days eating normally, quote, normally, with days when calorie consumption is dramatically restricted. So you can kind of do that on alternate days, on and off, or where 2 days each week are classified as fasting days. So that's not terrible deprivation, but, you know, you have to get out of your routine. So you can do it, you know, Monday is a fast day, Tuesday is a regular day, Wednesday, you know, and so on. Or you can just say, I'm going to eat normally 5 days a week, but let's pick 2 days each week. Tuesdays and Thursdays are going to be my fasting days. It's going to be have very, very low calorie intake. And what they found is that fasting can limit inflammation. It can improve levels of sugars and fats in your circulation and reduce blood pressure. And when you're fasting, your body then burns down its fat stores. It no longer can rely on quick, immediate carbohydrates. And that puts you in a state of ketosis, which improves metabolism and, according to the research, reduces oxidative stress, which is a factor in diabetes. And this is not a new concept, because before we had drugs, scientists have long known and doctors have employed intermittent fasting, which research clearly shows can cut the incidence of diabetes in lab animals. It's also very Paleolithic. And we talk about the Paleolithic diet. We decide, you know, that what did Paleolithic man eat? Well, they ate roots and berries, and they ate game. But one aspect of the Paleo lifestyle is that there just weren't that much food all the time. There were periodic times of drought or famine, or the supply of wild game dwindled, and people were hungry. And hence, I wrote a blog, and you can find it at drhoffman.com under the articles. It's entitled "Repeat After Me: Hunger Is My Friend." And a lot of people perceive hunger as a terrible form of deprivation, as a state to be avoided at all costs. People get really bent out of shape when they're hungry. And it's especially tough when you need to lose weight, but you're hungry. And often you have, if you're diabetic, because you're producing excess insulin, when you don't eat, the high insulin drives your blood sugar really low. And you go through terrible pangs of withdrawal and food deprivation. But the reason I wrote this is that I think people should recognize that hunger is a normal physiologic state. Yeah, it's unpleasant, but especially if you're diabetic or pre-diabetic, hunger is your friend. It's actually something to be cultivated, because in modern society, the natural order of things does not allow us a lot of opportunities to be hungry, except if you're an Orthodox practitioner of religion and you have to celebrate Ramadan or Yom Kippur or other. You know, every religion has its own fasting holidays. But for the vast majority of us secular Americans, there's no time when we have restricted access to food. So the imposition of some self-induced food deprivation, i.e. intermittent fasting, can be of benefit. According to one of the researchers involved with this study about intermittent fasting, he says, quote, intermittent fasting might achieve much of the benefits seen with bariatric surgery, but without the costs, restriction on numbers, and risks associated with surgery. Whether intermittent fasting can be used as a tool to prevent diabetes in those individuals at high risk or to prevent progression in those recently diagnosed with type 2 diabetes remains a tantalizing notion. And we are currently in preparation for clinical trials to assess the effectiveness of this form of lifestyle intervention in various patient groups. They say here, I don't know the name of the book in England, but it's something easy to look up. Intermittent fasting is an increasingly popular diet plan that hit the headlines in Christmas of 2012 after the release of a book on the subject. But it's, you know, probably for good reason. It hasn't made it across the pond, so to speak, because it's painful. It's a form of deprivation and sacrifice and pain and discomfort. So, you know, Americans are not going to too readily embrace fasting as a means of treating or addressing diabetes. But, you know, it's interesting that they have to do studies, all these sophisticated studies, to determine whether this is a good way to go. It would seem intuitive that this is going to be a real home run in terms of dealing with diabetes, pre-diabetes, metabolic syndrome. And look, I mean, I got to say that the vast majority of our patients at the Hoffman Center, we don't utilize fasting because fasting is a little extreme. But getting patients on a very low carbohydrate diet also induces ketosis. And ketosis is a very effective tool for dealing with diabetes. This is the mainstay of the Atkins approach. My nutritionist at the Hoffman Center, Layla Mudin, spent time in her early career at the Atkins Center before Dr. Atkins passed away, and saw, you know, on a daily basis what a very low carbohydrate diet can do to address diabetes. And I think Drew Carey is probably a good celebrity role model for the efficacy of that kind of approach, because you look at him, he's totally transformed. I mean, he used to be a big fat guy, and this is something that he claims to have undertaken very successfully as a way of dealing with his diabetes diagnosis. So maybe Tom Hanks should pay a visit to Drew Carey or to a nutritionally oriented physician who incorporates some of these techniques in dealing with diabetes. Now let's take a look at the effects of exercise on diabetes. It turns out that exercise is one of the best ways that you can sensitize your cells to insulin. Remember, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, is a condition not enough insulin usually. It's a condition of you're making plenty of insulin, even too much insulin, but your cells are no longer sensitive. They are resistant to insulin. It's called insulin resistance. So exercise is great for resensitizing all your cells to the effects of insulin, permitting insulin to do its job, and thus helping to lower your blood sugar and help you overcome diabetes. So there's a study, and this came out, this actually was just reported on this month. Headline, exercise as good as drugs at preventing repeat heart attack, study finds. So you're going to say, well, that's about heart attacks. This is not a study about diabetes. Actually, it is. This is from the Wall Street Journal. The study was published in the British Medical Journal, and it looked at the relationship between exercise and four health conditions: type 2 diabetes, repeat heart attacks, repeat strokes, and heart failure. Okay. So what they found, well, here's the experiment. They took 14,700 participants, and they were either put on exercise programs, or they looked at a large number of individuals who were given medications. So actually, there were much fewer people who were just put on exercise programs, because the vast majority of people get medications to prevent subsequent heart attacks, repeat strokes, heart failure, and to treat diabetes. And what they found was that in three of the four conditions studied, exercise was as effective as or possibly more effective than drug treatments. Now, there was one condition where exercise wasn't as effective as a drug treatment, and that was heart failure. And perhaps not surprisingly, I mean, look, there's something to be said for exercise and heart failure, because you can, the heart's a muscle and you can strengthen it. But in the three other conditions, type 2 diabetes, prevention of a subsequent heart attack after you first had a heart attack, or prevention of stroke after an initial stroke, the drugs didn't do even as well as the exercise, or the exercise was equivalent. So what they are saying here is the results are exciting, in quotes, because they suggest there's enough evidence now to justify implementing exercise programs as part of the treatment for these conditions. And I say that's a big duh, right? I mean, they had to do the research. I mean, look, I guess this is science and, you know, a lot of stuff that's intuitive and something that we inherently know. We have to test out the hypothesis. But what they want to discern in future studies is what types of exercise work best and for which patients, so that they can actually determine which patients might benefit the most from exercise. But they emphasize that doctors should systematically encourage and support patients to engage in exercise therapeutically, and they should exhort patients to undertake exercise programs. You know, why don't they do enough studies like this? Well, according to one of the study authors, a Dr. Mead, the relatively small number of exercise trials compared with drug trials is due to a combination of factors, including better funding for drug companies and also the complexity of carrying out exercise studies, because it's a lot easier to tell people to take a pill. And it's harder to do exercise studies. And, oh, by the way, what's the placebo for an exercise? Well, sometimes the placebo for an exercise is to, you know, tell people to, I don't know, read a book on how to take care of yourself. Something. They're doing something, but they're not exercising. And they note that exercise has also been shown to be helpful in a number of other conditions, including depression, cognition, blood pressure, and for cancer treatment, certain types of cancer, particularly breast cancer, prostate cancer, it's now been demonstrated that exercise has a positive impact on the prognosis of patients with these cancers. So, Tom Hanks, sounds like two major interventions. One would be a low-calorie but overall lower carbohydrate diet, perhaps intermittent fasting as a feature of that, though not necessarily, and exercise could turn this around big time. And I got to tell you, this is something that, you know, I specialize in dealing with in my practice. I just love seeing patients like Tom Hanks come in, not necessarily celebrities, because celebrities can be a big pain in the you-know-what. Some of them are prima donnas, but some of them are just, you know, very, very nice, unassuming individuals with great personalities. But a lot of our patients come in diabetic or pre-diabetic. I recall one patient who came in, and I just didn't think he was going to be able to do it. He came in with a hemoglobin A1C of over 10. And I thought, you know, I had to tell him up front, and it broke his heart. I said, look, I don't know if I can turn your diabetes around with just diet and exercise and supplements. And we'll talk about some supplements in just a moment. And he was really disappointed because he wanted to do it without medications. He says, look, don't feel crushed if you can't do it without medication. I'm just saying, we'll see how well you can do. And, you know, your body's going to vote. You know, maybe you'll get part of the way there. It also depends on how strictly you can comply with this, because frankly, the limiting factor is sometimes patient compliance. They don't exercise as much as you'd like them to, or they don't restrict their calories or their carbohydrates as much as you'd like them to. It's very hard. So he comes back in a couple of months, and to my enormous surprise, 10 is now down to about 6.5. And I said, you're really exceeding my expectation. You're almost, in the safe zone, but, let's see. And it takes actually about 3 or 4 months to normalize hemoglobin A1C with medication or with diet, whatever you're using. And he came back in, and to my immense surprise, it is not only under 6, it's like 5.4. It's like he went from being a very diabetic person to a very normal person. The story behind this is, you know, how did he get there? Well, what happened was he is a very active guy. He is a farmer. He's actually a dentist, but he spends a lot of time up on his farm. And he was working, and he hurt his back. And his back, he was in excruciating pain, so he stopped working. And he sat around, and he got really depressed, and he started eating a lot of junk food and gained some weight. He wasn't terribly obese. He just had a kind of a pot belly on a light frame, and that made all the difference in the world. And so, you know, we also gave him some things that would help his back pain, some natural anti-inflammatory supplements. And, you know, his wife's a yoga teacher, so she gave him yoga rehabilitation. And he just did astoundingly well. Now he's just doing great, surpassing my expectation. Now, not every patient is able to achieve total reversal of their abnormal blood sugar. And often the question is asked, does that mean I'm not diabetic anymore? And the answer is, technically you're not diabetic, but you retain the susceptibility to get diabetic if you don't exercise as much, if you don't eat with his rigorous dietary restriction, or sometimes the condition just evolves and gets worse. Your pancreas wears out with age. There's a deterioration of function, and sometimes you can go back to being diabetic. But the vast majority of patients can turn things around. There are many studies now looking at the effects of lifestyle and type 2 diabetes. That's totally the way to go. Not medication. I reluctantly prescribe medication in just a very small handful of my patients, sometimes because their diabetes is too far gone, and sometimes because they're just not able to implement the program quite as rigorously as they need to. So let's take a look at supplements. Supplements that make a difference. Obviously, chromium can make a difference. A recent study looked at chromium in patients with diabetes who had adequate chromium intake, and it turned out that taking more chromium didn't make a big difference. But if in chromium deficient patients with diabetes, chromium can help blood sugar control. One of the things that I really like for diabetes is berberine. Berberine is an extract of golden seal or Oregon grapefruit. I use a product called CM Core by a company called Orthomolecular. It's available on our website at drhoffman.com. It is, in some studies, it's been shown to be as effective as metformin. And it works in a different way than metformin to help metabolism. And it's not exactly clear how it works, but one of the ways it may work is it may work on intestinal flora. And it's been shown that certain types of intestinal flora can predispose you to diabetes and insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, and the overgrowth of harmful bacteria may be a factor for some people. So suppressing the harmful bacteria with a natural antimicrobial like berberine may be part of the way it works. I'm sure there are other pathways by which it affects metabolism. Vitamin D is very important for diabetics because inadequate vitamin D can make you more insulin resistant. Many diabetics require a lot more vitamin D than normal folks, as much as 5,000 international units or more per day to normalize their vitamin D. Also, certain herbs, banaba, gymnema, have been shown to be effective for diabetes in Ayurvedic medicine. Gymnema silvestri is referred to as sugar destroyer. And it's also been shown that omega-3 fatty acids can make a difference. Magnesium may make a difference as well in terms of helping to regulate blood sugar. B vitamins seem to rev the citric acid cycle, which is the energy utilization cycle of the body. Perhaps other nutrients like carnitine and coenzyme Q10 can help patients who have a schleppy metabolism achieve a more efficient metabolism. Another factor that can make a huge difference, especially in men, is testosterone. And many men who have diabetes or prediabetes, I mean, it's not a coincidence that this develops in middle age, is testosterone deficiency. And by giving men testosterone, a couple of things happen. One is you get a better sugar utilization and reduced insulin resistance, reduced inflammation, and you get a little more oomph and a little more initiative and energy. There's sort of a vicious cycle of fatigue and lethargy that ensues in midlife for men and women, but particularly for men. And they sit around, they develop a pot belly, they become less sexy. And that's the low T syndrome that you see sometimes advertised in TV commercials. And by giving testosterone to men, they get a little more oomph. They go to the gym, they work out, and they exercise, and they begin to turn things around. It's a great kickstart for men who are trying to overcome type 2 diabetes. Sometimes at the end of the day, they don't require testosterone at all after they've transformed their bodies and they've gotten into a healthier pattern of exercise and eating after losing weight. And in fact, excess weight, body fat, interferes with utilization and production of testosterone. So say you're producing a finite amount of testosterone and you weigh 230. Well, if you drop down to 190, you're still producing the same finite amount of testosterone, but there's less body to push around. There's less body fat that can compete with the testosterone. And sometimes men can completely relinquish the testosterone. So this is a very, very important thing to look for in men with diabetes. And, you know, Tom Hanks, certainly, you know, he's at that age, 57, where that might be happening for him. And for both sexes, DHEA can be used. In men, you can use higher doses, 25 or 50. In women, you can use 5 or 10 or at most 25. And that, too, can help with energy and oomph and blood sugar metabolism and can make a difference. So to sum up, you know, suggestions for Tom Hanks or, you know, for people using the Tom Hanks situation as a teachable moment, you know, never let a celebrity illness go to waste, to paraphrase Rahm Emanuel, is we should be on not just a better diet because, you know, he's probably skipping dessert, you know, maybe eating a less junk food, but, you know, really very, very concerted dietary interventions, a very low carbohydrate diet. And when you're using carbohydrates, make them low glycemic or low glycemic load carbohydrates, very slow time release carbohydrates that are mixed in with a lot of fiber. Check out the salad and salmon diet. Look at the paleo diet. Consider a low carb diet like the Atkins diet. And make sure that lots of exercise is in the equation, both types of exercise, aerobic and strength. Because to the extent that you, I mean, aerobic exercise is great. You can get on the elliptical and burn off calories and improve your insulin resistance. But another factor, exercise promotes muscle development, muscle growth. The more muscle you have, the more glycogen depots you have, the more that stabilizes your blood sugar. So building muscle, and that's where testosterone and DHEA can come in, can help you alleviate your diabetes. You want to increase your ratio of muscle to fat, not just decrease your fat. And that will be that's the answer for many patients with type 2 diabetes. So to Tom Hanks, I suggest he pull out an old reel of the movie Castaway from the year 2000, review it very carefully, do whatever you did to get to that role. I know it wasn't easy, but for sure, if you get to that state of living, you won't have to worry about diabetes. You may have to worry about getting too emaciated or wasting away, but certainly diabetes will disappear as a concern. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.